Random House Audio presents Resilience, Reflections on the Burdens and Gifts of Facing Life's Adversities by Elizabeth Edwards. Read by the author.
Chapter 1, 1990. I stood at the sink in an impossibly bright hospital room, washing my face, washing away the heat that with the doctor's words had come rushing to my face and neck and chest, to fill every pore, to gather in the corners of my eyes, and to line my lips and thicken my tongue. "He will never walk. His brain is dead," the doctor had said. It still burned. How much cold water would it take the hot sting out of those words? My father lay immobile behind me, a crisp sheet folded neatly across his chest, the crease apparently to be forever perfect above his forever still form. I had not been able to bear to see him like that any longer, so I turned away and instead watched my own warped reflection in the metal mirror that seemed to mimic the distortions within me. The doctor's words were all I could hear inside my head, but they were too immense, too life-changing to stay in my head. They spilled out and filled the room, bouncing back from the walls and the metal me in the mirror, and with every echo a new torment. "He will not walk. His brain is dead. He will not walk. His brain is dead." I kept cupping water to my face, unable to cool the heat, but equally unable to stop trying. The day before, this solid man who would be 70 in 4 days, who still had cannonballs for shoulders and the calf muscles of a 25-year-old fullback, had fallen over while eating a salad for dinner. He had played tennis in the morning and had gone biking in the afternoon. He came in to dinner after planting spring flowers in the yard. Every minute of his day was a test of his body, a test he passed over and over again. And then with no warning, a massive stroke, and he could not move from the floor. I was 40 years old, and I had never seen him fail at a single physical thing he had tried to do. Not once in 40 years. I closed my eyes as I cupped the water, and the images of my well father, strong and full of life, gathered on top of one another. Eating a hot pepper from his garden in Naples and thinking it a green pepper, his face goes flush, tears fill his eyes, his glasses fog up, but he chews on. And then, grinning at his astonished family, he gets up and picks another. The awestruck faces of the enlisted men he commanded in Japan when he came out of the pool into which they had thrown him, and with his soaking wet flight suit clinging to him, they saw his supremely muscled form outlined. News that he had made captain had come in while he was on an early morning flight, so when he stepped out of the jet in his flight suit, his squadron had rallied around him, cheering, and had thrown him into the pool in giddy celebration. I always suspected that the vision of him earned him a respect from those enlisted men that morning that the additional stripe on his sleeve would not have won him. I had sat with him at Bethesda Naval Hospital when he had 4 discs in his spine fused, the final remedy 2 decades after his back was injured, when the wheels on the jet he was getting ready to pilot collapsed beneath the plane on the tarmac. He should have been groggy and still in the hours after recovery, but he was smiling at everyone and teasing the nurses by pretending to smoke an endless series of imaginary cigarettes. Within weeks, he was back on his bicycle, and within months, he was back on the tennis court. There was the time his nose was flattened in college in a football game. The doctor said it was so crushed that he could choose whatever shape he wanted, since they were starting from scratch. So he chose the shape he had had before, and he took up lacrosse, and he was an All-American his first year. He used to lift women up, my mother and her friends, and twirl them head over heels like batons. Proper women in 1950s shirtwaists ignored the fact that their garter belts had been on display, and they giggled to be treated as girls again. He carried my brother, my sister, and me all at once on his wide shoulders upstairs to bed when we were youngsters, as if we were stuffed animals. Now, impossibly, he lay dying behind me, unable to move, unable to speak. The doctor had called us into the room to tell us. My sister sat with her arm around my mother. My brother sat holding our father's hand. I stood at the foot of the bed, my eyes on my father's still face, not on the doctor I'd never seen before. Each of us cried, not in a wailing way, but in low, lonely moans. The doctor talked on about the effect of the stroke on the blood flow to his brain, and we each half listened, for truthfully, nothing after "his brain is dead" could penetrate. Tracks of silent tears covered all of our cheeks. When the doctor left, we all hugged one another, grieving our collective loss and our individual ones. Then everyone else left the room. I had to tell my children, 10-year-old Wade and 8-year-old Kate, where they waited in the hall with their father, and I had to wash my face before I would tell them. I could clean the tear tracks, but the heat would not go away. I gave up and turned to leave and face the children. As I turned, I looked again at my father, but now he was looking back. He was still immobile, his huge bulk still pinned beneath the tight sheets, but his eyes were open. Not just open, but wide dishes of panic. He could not speak, and yet he did. We stood staring at one another, I haven't any idea how long, and he said, or his eyes said, "I am here. I am not dead. I am here. I want to live." I answered back in words. "Don't worry," I said. "We know. We're not giving up on you." And I marched past my family to the nurse's station and told them that doctor was not allowed back into my father's room under any circumstances. This was April 18th, 1990. We buried my father in April of 2008. Oh, his body kept failing him little by little until the last of him slipped away 18 years later. But in between, he learned to drive again in a fairly frightening fashion and drove until his response time was demonstrably too slow and we could not let him drive any longer. He talked again in an odd and sometimes inappropriately scatological way. The boobs are boiling, but still making people smile until he no longer could talk easily, and losing confidence in his voice, he started talking again with his eyes. He danced with my mother for nearly a dozen more years. He never biked or played tennis again, but he traveled. He went to Poland and Spain. He took a cruise and watched the whales off the Alaskan coast. He voted for his son-in-law for Vice President of the United States. And he was there to bury his oldest grandson, my firstborn. But he was also there to hold 4 more grandchildren, Ty and Lewis and Emma Claire and Jack, and even 2 great-grandchildren, Anna and Zachary, who were born after his stroke. In the end, he was surrounded by family, his wife of nearly 60 years, his children and grandchildren, his sister and her children, and finally, of his own will, he quit fighting and let go. There were times in the 18 years more that he lived when he wanted to give up, when he didn't want to keep fighting to drive or to dance or to live. I remember sitting with him once after my son Wade died. We were going through a workbook his rehabilitation therapist had assigned him. I would read, he would answer questions. He got them right at first, and then he started to miss them. A few at first, and then all of them. His frustration mounted, and he finally said with awkward resignation that he was a burden he promised himself he would never be, and he would just as soon die. I was stunned and angry. I wanted him to live so badly. How could he not want it too? "If you could have Wade back," I asked, "but only in your exact condition, no better, would you take him?" He raised his head a little, and his deep brown eyes met mine. He nodded. "Then you understand how we feel. We know it is not perfect, but nothing really ever is." I reached for his hand and told him, "You are here, and that is what I want." And I added, "If you think that this is getting you out of finishing this assignment, you are wrong." He opened his mouth. It was not the wide smile I remembered, but the gap between his 2 front teeth showed, and that was smile enough for me. There is nothing about resilience that I can say that my father did not first utter silently in 18 years of living inside a 2-dimensional cutout of himself. From the first moment when he forced open his eyes to tell me that he was alive, through all the setbacks of a body on which he had relied that subsequently failed him, little by little, he held on to whatever he had, however meager it was. He managed somehow to turn whatever he held on to into precisely what he needed to survive. When in the first year he had the audacity to tell the rehabilitation counselor that he wanted to drive, or when in the 8th year he danced with my mother, or when in year 16.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?